All right, I'm going to bring up the screen share. There it is. And we'll start. We're going to chant verses 1 through 30. And we'll save the other verses for during class. Oh, yeah, I got to mute everybody. I forgot. Okay, you're all muted, and we will chant. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free without distraction always day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it's stay. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic dharma friends more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. my mother's, each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening, to fully and wholeheartedly exchange my happiness for others' suffering. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone, my inferior or peer, through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head to take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply. No matter how to vanquish them, I fight to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Since pleasures and desire are like salt water, the more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know my own mind's nature and refrain from grasping onto subject object signs. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it as truly real, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. All forms of suffering are just like dreaming that my beloved child has passed away. Appearances like these are just delusions. To take them as true drains my energy. When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff, without hope for reward or benefit, to generously give away a gift? This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If through a lack of ethical conduct, I can't accomplish my own benefit, then any aspiration to achieve the benefit of others is a joke. To keep and guard my ethical conduct completely free from worldly influence, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If listeners and solitary Buddhas, in striving just for their own benefit, are seen to focus with the same resolve as putting out a fire on their head, since my aim is to benefit all beings and effort is the source of all good traits, I must engage with joyful perseverance. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. To vanquish my emotionality, I need insight based in tranquility. To understand this and to cultivate a stable, focused meditative state, not getting stuck in the four formless realms, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. The five perfections lacking inner wisdom are not enough for full awakening. To cultivate the wisdom of true knowing, united with the path of skillful means, and not conceive the three parameters, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And here we are. I'm going to just unmute everybody for a minute so we can chat. And we're all set. If anybody has anything you want to say before we start our class. Oh, there's Kathy and Macy have arrived, and Deidre and Lama Jinzong.
Howdy.
Howdy. How's life in California?
It's beautiful.
Joanne and I were just remarking that North Carolina and Virginia are also beautiful today.
Yeah, everything is blooming like at once. It's just pretty amazing.
Nice.
And but it's crazy.
Yes, you have a lot going on. You have a lot going on there.
Yep.
And Lama Jinzong, how's KTC?
Quiet during the day. I'm on breakfast, Samsung's on dinner, because if people, we have several people over at Walden, and we have a lot of guests here who are staying here to go over to the Sakya Trichin teachings over in Walden. So I have to do breakfast and Samsung's doing dinners because other people are at the Karmapas, you know, at the Moonlam.
Right.
So, you know. But we're keeping the home fires burning.
Yeah, we see a few of them on our screens.
Yes, we do.
And thank you for forwarding the teaching link.
I actually tried to watch today's teaching, and the Chinese was fine, but the English link, I know that because the English link kept buffering. So I finally said, you know, and people were, you know, it kept stopping and then going and stopping. So I just thought I'll watch it later on.
Yeah.
They seem to be about 30 minutes to 45 minutes, the teachings, you know, there. So when I find the second link, I'll send it to everyone, for anyone.
I actually watched some of this today's teaching via Facebook.
Oh, were you able to see it clearly? Did it go?
Yeah, yeah, there wasn't any. I didn't see a lot, but because I didn't have time, but I caught a few minutes.
Yeah, it looks really, I mean, the big problem is craving. I got that point.
Yes. But I'm trying to remember what he was talking about when I listened, and I can't.
I decided that I would prepare for your class. I actually re-listened to, because the four verses today was actually, it began halfway near the end of the fourth session and then into the fifth session. So
yeah, I actually have the parts for the
fourth. Oh, you're kidding, because I transcribed all of that.
you're welcome to present those.
No,
it was only session five I wasn't able to watch, but the way I expressed it was confusing, and you're absolutely welcome to jump in and
summarize. No, I'm going to let you, because I thought the best thing was to just have you present each verse, and then if there's anything that was not already presented by you from the other sources, I could add what he said.
Okay, that sounds like a plan.
A plan.
Okay, great. Yes, Lama Jensung volunteered to fill in what I haven't been able to watch yet from session five of His Holiness's teachings on the 37 practices.
Already, how do you get to it on Facebook? Because I keep going to Nong Foundation, which gets me to YouTube. So
are you on if you have a Facebook account?
I do. Well, I never really go on Facebook.
Right. Well, if you're signed up for the Karmapa's page, Facebook page, then they give you a notification. It just pops up right in your newsfeed. So I just open up Facebook and he's right there. And for some reason, I think because I accidentally clicked on Spanish the first time I watched the teaching.
Yeah, it comes up in Spanish.
But it also gives me the English. It seems to think I'm just interested in everything Spanish now. So it's my chance to learn Spanish, I guess.
Hi, all Valerie. Right.
What? Sorry?
I said, hi, Valerie.
Yes. Hi, Valerie.
All right. Anything else we wanted to say before we do the prayers? In which case, I will mute everybody. Okay, so you're all muted and can unmute at will, as always. So let's just take a moment to bring our minds to rest, to prepare ourselves for attentively and mindfully chanting our introductory prayers, in which we state our, you know, we renew our refuge and restate our commitment to bodhicitta, and then gather merit to empower our practice. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. To all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Dadan Sanshan Tom Che Lo Che Su Dro Arzin Ji Lap Ji Sol Che Lam Du Dro Arzin Ji Lap Ji Sol Lam Chul Pa Sa Arzin Ji Lap Ji Sol Chul Pa Ye She Su Cha Arzin Ji Lap Ji Sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang alu dang nu jin ke chulbum da da mi ke nam dang drawa kunchi draki jit sampar tamchi ke du daki chitento. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And then the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Restating our commitment to both aspiration bodhicitta and action bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And finally, the four limitless aspirations, the four immeasurables, are aspirations on behalf of ourselves and all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never lose touch with true happiness, which harbors no suffering. May they come to rest in vast, impartial equanimity, free from attachment and aversion. So we'll do the two wings of awakening meditation today, sort of the classic mind training, first 2 points of mind training. So again, checking in with our posture if we didn't already, straight and relaxed, in a comfortable seat, as comfortable as you can be. Letting our attention descend from our thoughts, our busyness, whatever it took to get here today, into our body, awareness of our body in this space, on this seat, in this present moment, what it actually feels like to be here. Just resting in that and letting go of random thoughts or not random thoughts. And this state of resting, non-distraction. We will contemplate the four reminders. First, the precious human existence, remembering, as we do every day, how very fortunate we are to have this opportunity to attain freedom in this lifetime. And remembering that it's very difficult to come by this freedom. The vast majority of beings do not have it, and it's very easy to lose it. So we need to make use of it while we have it. And then the second reminder, impermanence and death, that we don't know when this opportunity will end. We could lose it at any moment through any number of circumstances. So we can't dawdle around. We can't waste time. We have to make use of it now. And then the law of karma, that what happens to us in the future is determined by our own actions, whether we experience happiness, suffering, or whether we actually liberate ourselves. It all depends on what we do now in this lifetime. Because after we die, we will no longer have a choice. And then the reminder that there's no use in just hoping and working for a better, happier life, a better, happier samsara in this life or the next life. All of samsara is confusion and suffering. So we need to use this lifetime, this precious human existence, while we have it, to free ourselves and others from it by engaging in the actions that will liberate us and help us to liberate others. from now, we empower our practice by requesting the blessing of the teacher or the Buddha. So visualizing the teacher we feel closest to, or the Buddha or Chenrezig, on the crown of our head in a body of light on the lotus and moon seat, smiling, radiating love and compassion, embodying bodhicitta, what we are trying to attain ourselves, embodying awakening, embodying the realization of emptiness and compassion. We simply request, with or without words, we request the blessing of the Lama or the Buddha that we may attain the same. And just through requesting it, we receive it, and then we let the visualization descend from the crown of our head into our heart center, continuing to radiate light, love, compassion, bodhicitta, and awakening. And whenever we remember to look, it's always there. The Lama or the teacher is always there. So we will bring our minds further to rest by following the breath for a few rounds. Or if you prefer open awareness or sensory perception, that's fine. Just use some technique of calm abiding to really let go and rest. And now, within this state of the mind resting, we will do the four steps to cultivate ultimate bodhicitta from the Great Path of Awakening, from the 7 points of mind training. First, look at all experience as a dream, not only our outer circumstances, but primarily whatever reactions are arising in our mind, whatever we're experiencing towards whatever may be happening internally and externally. We look at it as if it might be a dream that we might wake up from. And knowing that we could wake up from it, we don't need to take it seriously. It doesn't need to be a big deal. Just like last night's dream. And then we turn our attention to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, looking at our own mind. And we tune in to the mind as opposed to its contents. We tune into that by asking ourselves, with or without words, to identify something about the mind. Does it have a shape or a color? Does it have a location? Is it inside the body somewhere? Is it outside the body? Where specifically is the mind located? Where does the mind end and appearances begin? Who's looking? Who's perceiving whatever we're perceiving? And we don't analyze or try to figure it out. We just rest in not being able to say what any of these things are. Just resting in looking at the mind. And then in step three, we let even the remedy release naturally. So having not found any identifiable characteristics or any location for the mind, we let go of even that concept. And that leaves us in step four, rest in the essence. The basis of everything. This means our Buddha nature. As Zhong Gong Kongfu says, it means replacing the mind in the nature of all phenomena, the natural state, which is the basis of everything, our Buddha nature. He says, let go and rest. Follow no train of thought, but rest evenly in a state in which mind itself is clear and free of conceptuality. Not trying to attain any specific mental state, but just resting in however it is. Nothing to figure out, nothing to fix, nothing to adjust, just resting as it is. If you find your mind wandering or fixating upon something or trying to change something, then you just let go. And then within this state of ultimate bodhicitta, without losing touch with this vast awareness, this alertness, this relaxation that we find ourselves in, this okayness with however things are in this moment, within that state we can practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. Everyone here knows how to do it. So I'll just go through the steps. First, bringing to mind a person or animal, or more than one, towards whom love and compassion naturally lies, your mother, your father, friend, a pet, someone who's been kind to you. Bring that person or animal to mind. And do taking and sending. On each breath, or every few breaths, whatever's more comfortable. Really feeling in your heart the wish to free them from suffering. And the happiness of seeing their suffering become less as you breathe it in and let it dissolve. And now we'll gradually, step by step, extend this feeling of compassion to all sentient beings, first by adding a person or people or animals that we have neutral feelings toward. A delivery person, a grocery checker, someone we see regularly in the street, the birds overhead or the earthworms under the ground. Knowing that they have suffering, even though we don't know what specifically it is, we breathe it in and free them from it. Sending them happiness, healing, whatever they need. And then if we can, you include someone that we find irritating, someone it's hard to feel compassion for. Probably not someone who brings up really strong feelings unless you feel very confident in your practice, but just someone who's a challenge. Breathe in their suffering with the heartfelt wish that they be free of it. Let it dissolve and breathe out whatever they need. Breathe out happiness, healing, and peace. And now extending our visualization to include all sentient beings in all six realms of existence, even the gods' realms, even the form and formless realms, breathing in their suffering, present, past, present, or future. Let it dissolve and breathe out the antidote. And now we think that we, ourselves, and all sentient beings are completely free from suffering. It's all been dissolved into our vast Buddha nature. They are completely filled with happiness, and we are too. And we are all completely awakened. And according to the instruction of Zhangguan Kongfu, we take a moment to rejoice in that. And now we can gradually let go of all conceptualization and visualization, go back to resting with an object or without an object, or in the nature of mind. Okay, so we have some verses still to chant. I have to look at my list to make sure I don't leave anything out. So I'm going to share the screen again, and we're going to chant the verses we're going to cover today. A feat never before attempted in this space. Four verses at one blow. We shall chant them. Verses 31 through 34. These are the four, and I'll say this again, but these are the four instructions from the sutra, from a specific sutra, and they all go together. If I don't look into my own confusion, I could be just a Buddhist counterfeit, a person who has all the outer trappings, but doesn't act the way the Buddha taught. To always analyze my own confusion and then take measures to abandon it. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If I, compelled by reactivity, relate another bodhisattva's fault, it undermines my own integrity, and I myself decline as a result. To never speak of faults or of mistakes of someone on the Mahayana path, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I am swayed by honor and reward, I may fall prey to quarrels and discord, and motivation may disintegrate to study, contemplate, and meditate, abandoning attachment to domains of benefactors, relatives, and friends. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Harsh words, besides upsetting other people, impair my bodhisattva practice too. To give up speech that's harsh, rude, or abusive, unpleasant for recipients to hear, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So I'm just going to chant them once now. If we have time at the end, we'll chant them again. I'm going to put that on my list of possible things to do. We may or may not have time. This is actually going to be pretty concise, generally. It's four verses, four deeply interconnected verses. And the main point the main point of these verses and all the verses is that we're actually meant to put each of them into practice starting now. It's not a historical document, the 37 practices. It's not an academic exercise. I mean, it is that a little bit with the study and contemplation and memorization, but that's not the main point. The main point is to actually do it. You know, we learn the three types of generosity, for example, so that when the opportunity arises to be generous, we remember, yes, this is the moment when I can be generous with the Dharma, or I can be generous by giving support and fearlessness, or this is when I could give away a material thing, letting go of whatever attachment I may have to it, like really giving it away. So this is really about actually doing these things that we're studying. The verses are also quite interwoven. They reinforce each other, and we're going to see that in some of the commentaries, that they sort of like verse 32 and 34 go together, or 31 and 33 sort of reflect each other. So does anybody have anything that they want to say or ask before we plunge into verse 31? Okay. But again, anytime, just get my attention or unmute yourself. And we're going to ask Lama Jinzong to jump in with His Holiness's commentary from his recent teachings when I don't have it. So I feel like there was something else I was going to say, but I don't remember what it was. So I have like a lot of little snippets. So commentaries generally are not real long on these verses. I was going to say, right, they're identified as, well, first of all, the Karmapa identified beginning with the six paramitas, this is the end. Like the main part of the practice was according to him, up to the paramitas. And from the paramitas on, it's similar to, say, the Great Path of Awakening, the 7 points of mind training, where the main points are actually like 1 through 4. And then the last three sets are like how to tell if it's working. You know, what are some guidelines? What are some commitments that we're making as we do these practices? So we're sort of in the end. All of the rest of the verses are just tying up the loose ends. It's sort of the end stage. But the main practice is really arousing ultimate bodhicitta and arousing relative bodhicitta, which are reversed. Actually, he has us, most of the verses are about relative bodhicitta. So we got the preliminaries. We've got the three motivations for the path, of which we need all three. And then we've got relative bodhicitta through verse 21. And then we have ultimate bodhicitta, verses 22 through 24. And then, according to His Holiness Karmapa, that is the main practice. That's it. Ultimate bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, whatever order you say them in. And then the paramitas, and the rest is how to like integrate all of that. And it's very clear in the paramitas that you're integrating relative bodhicitta, which is in most cases, the actual practice, generosity, being generous to somebody, being patient with somebody, arousing compassion instead of irritation, but mixed with ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom that realizes emptiness. And so we continue with that. This is an integration of wisdom and compassion, ultimate and relative bodhicitta. So verse 31... We're going to start with Dengo Chensi Rinpoche on that one. So verse 31 is on page 175 if you want to look. I'm just really doing snippets here. Maybe a few more from verse 31. Because he says everything in just such a lovely, perfect way. And interestingly, the different commentaries in this particular case with these verses, they sometimes say quite different things. They bring up different aspects of the verse. I see Marilyn nodding, so she has probably noticed this as well. So Dingo Chensi says in the second paragraph, so wait a minute, so what is the verse? The verse is, because we're doing four today, it may be a little harder to keep track. So the first verse is to examine and give up my own confusion. If I don't look into my own confusion, I could be just a Buddhist counterfeit, a fake Buddhist, a person who has all the outer trappings. I have my shrine.
I, you know, have my practice. I sit and meditate, or I chant every day, but doesn't act the way the Buddha taught. To always analyze my own confusion and then take measures to abandon it. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this is about looking at our own confusion, not letting ourselves get away with stuff as bodhisattvas. And it's going to fit neatly into the next one, which is about looking at other people's faults, which is what we really like to do. We don't like to look at our own, but this is about our first job. Our first job as a bodhisattva, beyond study, practice, and study, contemplation, and meditation, is to focus on our own confusion. We're clearing up our own confusion. We're putting on our own oxygen mask first. Then we can help people with their faults, because then we won't be doing it from a judgmental point of view. So Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche says, intellectually, you can probably recognize right from wrong and truth from delusion. Like, we know what that looks like. But unless you apply that knowledge in practice all the time, there can be no liberation. So there's no breaks. There's no times when we get to say, I'm just going to let myself get away with this thing. I have to do it. It feels so good. I just have to do it right now. So unless you apply it in practice all the time, there's no liberation. You have to bring your own wild mind under control by yourself. No one else can do it for you. No one else but you can know when you have fallen into delusion and when you are free from it. So to speak to the language here, some of the translations call it delusion and some call it confusion. Tony Duff in his Illuminator Dictionary says confusion is actually the best translation, but he says it's acceptable to call it delusion as well. It just means seeing things in a way that they don't exist. So no one else but you can know when you have fallen into delusion and when you are free from it. So what is delusion? It's like when we solidify reality. How do we solidify reality? How do we recognize that we're confused? We're having an opinion. We're having a judgment. We're putting up a barrier between our seeing everything as separate from us. those are signs that we're confused. I'm absolutely sure that I'm right and you're wrong. Like, that's confusion. So the only way to do it is to keep looking into your own mind as if you were using a mirror. Just as a mirror enables you to check if your face is dirty and see where the dirt is, so too, being constantly present in every situation. So that's the key. You could underline those words, get the tattoo. Being constantly present in every situation. You don't let your mind wander away from knowing what, you know, from being able to separate your opinion about something from what's actually there, to give an example. So being constantly present in every situation and looking within at your own mind allows you to see whether or not your thoughts, words, and deeds are in accordance with the Dharma. And Lama Jinzong spoke, I think, last week to what His Holiness Karmapa said about mindfulness and alertness, or whatever the words were used. Do you have anything to say about that, Lama Jinzong? If you don't, that's fine. But if you remember, okay, skip that. but anyway, but that's the point, is to always...
I was waiting to get your attention.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize for that. Yeah, I thought it was like, no. I'm glad I misinterpreted. So thank you for unmuting.
In the context of the teaching of the 37 practices of Bodhisattva, he spoke of mindfulness and vigilance. Mindfulness being that you simply remember what's the right thing to do and remember what's the wrong thing to do, and vigilance being the actual being conscious of what your body, speech, and mind are actually doing. So that's if that answers your
question. Yeah, and I think that's what Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche is saying here too. So it's helpful to have it put a different way. So it says, constantly being present in every situation and looking within at your own mind allows you to see whether or not your thoughts, words, and deeds are in accordance with the Dharma. And then he goes on to say, identify your own shortcomings, but never those of other people. So that speaks to the next verse as well. And then on page 176, he says, as soon as negative emotions arise, swoop down on them with mindfulness. So we have now another metaphor. Trungpa Rinpoche is a stomp on them or stamp on them. And then Kathy always has. Kathy, what's the one that you always remember? Face demand.
And avert.
Face and avert. Okay. So these are, what's that? From the Dalai Lama. Right. Face and avert. So we now have three metaphors for what to do when negative emotions arise. We can stomp on them. We can face them and avert them. We can swoop down on them with mindfulness. I think you would stamp on them with mindfulness, face them with mindfulness. Mindfulness is the key here. And he says, whenever positive thoughts arise, reinforce them. And I'm not going to go into what he says here using the three supreme points. You can look that up for yourself if you want to know. It's in verse 10. We know the methods. Just look at them and apply whatever method you use to deal with emotional reactivity. And then he has a nice verse from Gampopa, which is the last thing I'm going to read from Dzogchenzi Rinpoche's commentary. At the bottom of 176, he says, as Gampopa said, to be learned in the Dharma but not refrain from wrong is a hidden fault of practitioners. To hold profound instructions but not transform oneself is a hidden fault of practitioners. And to skillfully praise oneself and skillfully disparage others is a hidden fault of practitioners. So this last line in particular speaks to the union of verse 31 and 32. Instead of skillfully praising ourselves, we should be looking to see where we're confused, like just be on that all the time. Like, what am I getting wrong here? What's between me and seeing this situation clearly? And then to skillfully disparage others is what we refrain from in verse 32. So that's Dzogchenzi Rinpoche in a very small nutshell. Second thing I wanted to share was from His Holiness's book, Traveling the Path to Compassion. He heads this section, and he includes verse 35 in this as avoiding pitfalls. That's the name of the chapter. So these are all pitfalls that we could fall into as a practitioner. We could fail to look at our own confusion. We could think as long as we're studying, contemplating, and meditating, then we're good. But we could let ourselves get away with all kinds of things in our daily conduct. So he says, I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from this. His Holiness Karmapa says, this stanza addresses those of us who call ourselves Dharma practitioners. What is the definition of practice? We could think about that for a moment. Do we know? Like, what do we mean by practice? Well, he says the definition of practice is taming our mind. And that was the Buddha's instruction in his four verse summary to refrain from negative actions, like the whole path, refrain from negative actions, engage only in positive actions, and tame our own mind completely. So taming our mind is what we do through practice. He says, those of us who are supposed to be practicing Dharma should carefully examine ourselves, our body, speech, and mind, and become mindful of what we are doing. Otherwise, it is quite possible that although we have the form of a practitioner, we are not really practicing Dharma. But, he says, and this is something that Pema Chodron will touch on as well, and also Ken MacLeod, I don't think it's all in this verse, but it's amongst the various verses. He says, watching carefully to find our own faults, however, does not mean that we have to look down on ourselves or feel that we are worse than others. We do not have to throw ourselves into the river. That is too extreme. So we'll get more on that thought from some other commentaries later. He says, we can observe how we are doing even before someone tells us what is wrong. We all have faults. That is natural and not surprising. We also know how to improve because we know or can learn what to correct and change. Further, we realize that what we are doing is for our own benefit. Like, it's to our benefit to be a little hard on ourselves. Not too hard. You know, we're not like beating ourselves on the head. We're not throwing ourselves away. We're not thinking, oh, I'll never, you know, the second kind of laziness, right? Thinking, I'll never be enlightened. I'm just not good enough. I have too many faults. The point of looking at faults is just to identify what we can correct in our behavior. And he points out we all have them. It doesn't make you a bad person or a worse person. But to remember that it's for our own benefit. This is what's going to wake us up if we look honestly at our own faults and do our best to fix them. So if we find some faults or mistakes that we need to change, there is nothing wrong with us. These are just what we need to work on. This is what is meant by taming our mind. He says, then we might ask, how do I examine my confusion? So he calls it confusion. Among the many different ways of investigating, there is one that we do all the time. Like, we know how to do this. We know how to look at our faults and identify them and know what's the right thing to do because we're used to doing it to other people. He says, we are always on the lookout for the faults of others, what problems they have or what is wrong with what they do and think. Our mind is turned outward to judge others and not inward to see what we ourselves are doing wrong or what problems we might have. So he says, this is a reversal of what we should actually be doing. We should be identifying our own faults and leaving other people alone. And he's going to talk more. He has some really interesting things to say about what it means, and so does Ken McLeod, what it means when we criticize other people. So we're very busy criticizing others, but what we need to do is to turn that towards ourselves. I also have number three is going to be from Pema Chidren, from her seminar at Omega in 2016. She says, this verse is about the importance of self-reflection without judgment. So she's echoing what His Holiness said. It's not about judging ourselves. It's not about finding fault with ourselves. It's about seeing what we're doing that needs correcting. So this verse is about the importance of self-reflection without judgment, a subtle and very important point. Judgment on top of seeing the pattern is just another story, label, conceptual limitation. It's not necessary to do that. To be able to acknowledge our own shortcomings with honesty and kindness is so liberating. It creates a situation like taking the blinders from your eyes or the plugs out of your ears, when you don't have to defend yourself and push things away, when you don't have to go into denial about your own problems, in short. You can actually look at them without judging yourself harshly. She says, it is like being freed of a whole storyline that allows you then to really perceive your world and recognize your interconnectedness with other people. It allows you to be deeply happy as your life goes on. All right, the next one is, okay, now we're going to look at what His Holiness Karmapa said. Do you have that really handy, Jinzong, for 31? I was just going to pick out a little bit of what he said, but whatever you've got is good. Oh, I should unmute you. That would be very helpful.
Okay. I just transcribed what he said. I mean, I didn't, I just took the time transcribing so I could just read what he said or, you know, but I guess the thing is.
Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
All right. So he said, can you hear that? I don't know what that noise is. Okay. It says, the point here is that a Mahayana practitioner must repeatedly examine their own, and he, or well, Yeshe Dramso says delusion. but he asks, why do we need to do this? What is wrong with not doing this? And he said, if we don't examine the state of our own delusion, we may assume that we possess attributes or qualities that we don't, and we will certainly be unaware of our own flaws or defects. And this can possibly lead to a situation which, because of our association with the Mahayana, we heedlessly assume that we possess the virtues of the Mahayana simply because of our association with that. So again, this just says that then as a result that, you know, internally you can be acting opposite to the Dharma while adopting the guise or appearance. But this is what I found interesting, because that's sort of, he says, Nagarjuna, however you say that, wrote that, although our eyes don't see ourselves but only others, nevertheless, our view of others can be a mirror unto ourselves. We see faults in others very easily, seemingly clearly, but often the faults that we see in others are simply our own projections of our own faults. For example, if someone is very angry, they will perceive everyone else as extremely angry because they project their anger onto others. In that way, your perception of others in general can be a bit of a mirror that you can use to see your own face. Especially, it is said, in the context of describing the relationship between a guru and a student, that the guru is the student's mirror, because the disciple or student can see their own flaws by seeing what they project onto the others, especially onto the guru. And then he said one other thing, if I may continue, that, I mean, I always found this interesting because, you know, people said, well, sometimes, like, what does that mean to say you're projecting onto someone else and seeing your faults? You know, what does that mean? That person's the one who said it. I didn't say it, so how is it a fault of mine? But I'm getting that what he's talking about is the underlying mental affliction. If you're if you're seeing things generally through the, you know, the glasses of anger, you know, the rose-colored glasses. If anger is what's informing your perceptions, then you're going to see everyone else as being motivated by anger. So it's like a deeper underlying than just the specific words they might say in that moment. And then he said, it is possible for us to, because of our identification with the Dharma, that we think, I'm a Buddhist, that I'm a practitioner, a Dharma practitioner, I practice the Mahayana. It's possible because of this identification with the Dharma we practice to deceive ourselves about our own actual state. And then His Holiness looked at himself as an example. And he said, well, I was recognized as a Karmapa at the age of 7, traveled to Serpu and studied under many lamas. You know, I consider myself as a Buddhist, as a practitioner of Buddhism. You know, you wouldn't doubt that. But he says, but then I ask myself, am I a good human being? Sometimes I'm a good human being, especially when things are going my way. Sometimes I think I'm not a good human being, especially when things are not going my way. But think about what that means. If we think of ourselves as practitioners of Mahayana Dharma, doesn't that mean that we should be not only a good human being all the time, but better than ordinary good human beings? He said, I think sometimes, because of our involvement with the Mahayana Dharma, we take for granted that we have these attributes of goodness and so on. So we need to go back and re-educate ourselves about what it is we are doing. And we do this in part by continuously, repeatedly examining our own mental state and becoming aware of the degree of our own delusion.
Thank you. Wonderful. So that's what we have for, that's all the resources that I have for verse 31. Yeah, John, I'm going to unmute you. Yeah, you're unmuted. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. Sorry, you were muted. So now you have to start again.
All right. So basically, I've never thought of it as being projecting. I've always looked at it as having a filter. Is that a bad word? I mean, not bad, but is that another word that could be used?
But semantic?
Filter.
You mean like semantic? Were you looking at it? Is that just semantics?
A synonym.
Oh, well.
Did you want to answer that? Limitations, I'm not being able to unmute you. Yeah, I can't unmute you, Limitations. Can you unmute yourself?
Okay. Well, he said the word he was looking for was a synonym. I was saying, was it just a question of like semantics, which is the same thing of just.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to leave Limitations unmuted in case she has anything to say. I would just say that it's different aspects. I mean, the basic meaning of confusion is that we look at things through the filter of our own junk. You know, our own storylines, our own opinions, our own judgments, all this reflexive stuff that taints how we see things and how we hear things. But this, when we say that the faults that we see in others are often our own projections, I think it's much more like what Lama Jinzong was relaying from the Karmapa, that if we are angry, then we see other people as angry. You know, we're projecting fear onto the world, then people seem scary. It's like directly related to our own emotional state, how we see other people. Do you have anything to add to that, Lama Jinzong?
No, I agree, which is why it really clarified for me, because I used to get confused thinking, oh, well, if that person's saying something and I'm saying that's wrong for them to say it. And I'm like, but I didn't have that specific thought. So how is that reflecting on me? I didn't really understand that it's really like you're saying, it's the emotional, you know, that's the emotion underlying that's informing the words that come out of your mouth. Like I understand that, like whatever mood you're in, that's going to inform the kinds of thoughts that you have, you know, or hear, or it's like, that will inform the tone that you're projecting, you know.
Yeah. So I would say that it's a specific kind of filter. I think you're right, John, that that's a kind, like the projection is a kind of filter, the specific filter being what our mind is doing at the moment. But I think there's other kinds of filters as well. Fanny?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I just to take that a little bit further, what I'm coming across is like, you know, noticing when you have your own lens, particularly with family dynamics, let's say, you know, and then walking in and trying to have a fresh point of view. And then the distinction between witnessing that, oh, this is sort of the dynamic, you know, discerning when it is that you're using your own filter, your own lens, versus like, that's just what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and then, oh, right. So my gauge was validated. You know, not that you seek that, but just discerning that, you know, as I'm living here in Kansas City, really for the first time being with, as an adult with my family, my extended family and my mom, you know, I'm, some of the things that I have felt both, I don't want to say positive, negative, just what is dynamic is being expressed. So I try to do my own work about, am I coming in with that filter, with that lens of inclusion, exclusion, you know, all those. Yeah. Are those. Yeah. So, you know, when that skillful means, you know, of when it's really the discernment of your own stuff, your own filter. It's complex in a way to really like separate it out.
Yeah. And that's exactly what the verse is exhorting us to do, is to look at that. You're unmuted, Lama.
I think it's very important here. I'd like to bring in one of the things that we were working with at the monastery when we were learning how to, you know, communicate better. We were reading this book called How to Have Difficult Conversations. And actually, one really essential point is that we can never know objectively what another person's intention is. And like this really, I thought it was like, I talk about something, as you say, children, to like tattoo on your arm, is that your reaction or your response to somebody's, whatever they've said, is never, ever equal to their intention. Because you are too colored by all of your stuff, and they're also colored by their stuff that you don't know. So that the most important point here is to never assume that how you react to something is ever equal to their intention. And that's a really important point, that we're living fully in subjectivity, that we've got our own crap and stuff, they equally do, and we can never know what's underlying what their actions, their thoughts. So it's always subjective.
Yeah. Thank you. And I would just add, I'll get to you in just a second, Deidre. I would just add that that's what it means to live in a dream. you know, we take it as not solid because we can't know the nature of it. It's all, it's our dream. It's our dream colliding with their dream. So thank you so much, Fanny and Jinzong. And now I'm unmuting Daedra.
Just one of the other things that I noticed, that His Holiness Karmapa said that when you find faults with another Mahayana practitioner, you actually take on that fault. That's the karma.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't mess around. Well, own it now.
I'm sorry?
Can you own it now?
Yeah, you own it now. Well, that's interesting.
Do I want to own that?
Well, that's interesting because one of the people who did the fourth three-year retreat, her name was Thering, Sasha, I think. She had a theory that as soon as you pointed out or even noticed the fault of another person, you were going to make the same mistake. She said that that happened to her all the time. Like, you notice somebody else messing up the chanting, then you're going to mess up the next line. And so I started paying attention to that, and it does seem to play out that way sometimes. All right, I'd like to get on. Oh, go ahead, Marilyn.
This will be very, this is very brief. You're using the word perception as opposed to appearance, which you were talking about a while ago, that you sort of were beginning to prefer. I think that's the key to all of this, that it's our perception that is confused.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, we're looking at things through the filter of our perceptions, to use John's word, the filter. Everything is filtered through whatever mechanism makes us perceive things in a certain way. And I love that Lama Jinzong pointed out that we can never know. You just can never, or that was you, Lama Jinzong, right? That we can never actually know what the other person's intention is. And sometimes we find out the hard way that we were wrong. So that's why it pays to not react in the moment, all of this. I would like to go on to cover the other verses. Mark, did you have something?
Yeah, just one real quick one. Was it?
Yeah, no problem.
Something that was said, I think it was a quote from a Karmapa that just now, the teaching, and he was saying something about happiness. And really the point of this, it's important to remember that what you're trying to do is liberate yourself from suffering and therefore be able to liberate other beings from suffering by understanding that in yourself. Anyway, that's being kind is like kind of, or compassion is kind of paramount, it seems like, rather than really analytical and ready to jump on your thoughts and all that.
Yes. Well, I think we have a lot of good segues now to the next verse, which we should be able to polish off pretty quickly. I'm probably not going to be able to bring in all of my resources, but we all have them. So for verse 32, so verse 32 is to avoid discussing the faults of bodhisattvas, other people on the path. If I, compelled by reactivity, relate another bodhisattva's fault, it undermines my own integrity and I myself decline as a result. I think Deidre's comment addressed that a bit. Yes, we take on the karma somehow of whatever it is we're criticizing. To never speak of faults or of mistakes of someone on the Mahayana path, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So I wanted to start with His Holiness Karmapa in the book, and then we'll go on to Lama Jinzong's presentation of what he said recently. But he said about this, he said, this instruction is not limited to bodhisattvas. We should not say bad things about anyone, whether or not they are bodhisattvas. So he expands it a bit there. He says, it's not the same thing, however, if we know that pointing out someone's mistakes will help them to change. And he talked about this in his recent teaching too, which Lama Jinzong will share with us in a moment. So if you know that you're saying, by saying something, it's actually going to be helpful to the person, then it could be okay, but there's an awful lot of red flags along the way. And all the commentaries pointed out different red flags. So he says, generally speaking, since it is not easy to change another person, we should avoid criticism. Like, is it really going to change them, or is it just going to be upsetting and make them defensive? That's the first question. Other people do not like to hear themselves being criticized. And further, laying out their faults will create problems and troubles for us. Now they're mad at us. Or maybe we're going to make the same mistake now. We who are supposed to be practicing the Dharma should be trying to do whatever brings happiness to ourselves and others. And I think that's, Mark was speaking to that too before we even got to it in this particular presentation. We're supposed to be trying to make people to make people happy and help them wake up. He says, since fault finding does not bring any benefit, we should carefully avoid it. He says, also, enumerating faults is not an effective way to bring about change. Even if we point out someone's faults all the time, it will rarely alter the person or make anything better. Can we relate to that? Like, does that seem true? Do people actually change because we tell them they're doing something wrong? Do we change because somebody points out our fault to us? Or do we just dig in? He says, if we really want to help someone, perhaps we can say something once in a pleasant way, harking to verse 34. That's a little foreshadowing of verse 34, like not to engage in any harsh speech. If we really want to help someone, perhaps we can say something one time in a pleasant way so that the person can readily understand. However, it is better not to repeat our comments, because if we keep mentioning faults, not only will it not truly help, it will disturb others pointlessly. Therefore, not mentioning the faults of others is the practice of a bodhisattva. So that's what the Karmapa wrote some years ago in his book. And Lama Jinzong, take it away.
So he uses one example. I don't know if I can speak of the, you know, the schism.
I just want to say, though, we have only about 25 minutes left. So,
okay, so
we just probably aren't going to have time for you to read everything.
No, I'm not, because in fact, not to worry, the next two, he said barely anything.
Okay. So this is Then go for it. I don't mean to curtail what you
want. No.
I
only want to say this because it's actually really helpful.
Yeah.
And I won't use that last example, so it will go quick. Okay, so the situation described in this stanza is where a person who practices the Mahayana recounts the wrongdoing or downfall of another Mahayana practitioner. If the one who's recounting the fault of another is motivated, though, by a mental affliction, a klesha, and usually in this case, he's just using it as an example, it could be jealousy of some kind, then the first person, the one who's speaking out of the faults, automatically becomes stained by this, and this speaks to Daedra, stained by this, their discipline is diminished, they become stained by that violation or downfall themselves. And it's because, in this case, the motivation for recounting the faults of others is jealousy. It's not a motivation of benevolence. Now, if a Mahayana practitioner speaks of the supposed downfall or violation of another Mahayana practitioner, of which that practitioner is wholly innocent, it's doubly bad. But even if the other person does possess the fault, or did engage in the downfall that you recount, if you recount or speak of it to them or to others out of jealousy or another klesha, it is still a great flaw on our part, because it's not enough to be right. It is necessary for a Mahayana practitioner that you're both right and helpful, that your motivation to be helpful to the other is to help the other person, and that you have some confidence that speaking to the other person of whatever it is they have done wrong will be helpful to them. In that situation, since your motivation is benevolent and not due to some mental affliction like jealousy or whatever, and because your understanding of the situation is correct, it's reasonable to assume it's going to be helpful, then it's fine to speak. But here's the point. If your motivation is a mental affliction such as jealousy or anger, it doesn't matter whether the downfall that you wish to speak about actually occurred or not. It's still wrong to talk about it. That being right is not enough. And that then he gave an example with the previous problems that happened with the factionalism in our lineage. And he said that each faction said they were right, that the truth was on their side. Each one therefore said that they were telling the truth and the other was not. And each faction at times exhibited a great deal of attachment and aversion and so on. Both factions adhere to the Karmakarji tradition, but nevertheless, this argument and factionalism went on for years. to the extent that it was motivated, if and when it was motivated, by attachment and aversion, then simply being right is not enough. So, I mean, why you would say something, it's not okay just because you think you're right. It's why you think you need to say anything at all.
Like, even if you know you're right, even if there's no doubt, you still shouldn't say it unless your motivation is 100% pure and you know that it's going to be helpful.
Right. Unless basically you're free of clinging to pride or arrogance or self, you know, puffing up your own self to say it. Yeah.
How about never? I guess never is when we can speak up about another person's faults, especially another bodhisattva. So thank you, Lama Jinzang. Thank you very much. I'm just going to pull in a couple of more sources, and then if anybody has anything they want to say. I was going to read a bit more from Ken MacLeod, but I'm just going to read his last little bit. He starts out, though, by saying that the reason we feel a need to criticize others is because we feel deficient in some way ourselves. And I think that that's a really acute observation. And we even in our culture say that we tear someone else down in order to build ourselves up. So that's what that means, that we're covering up some fault in ourselves by making someone else look bad to themselves or others. So he says, here's Ken's advice. When you feel the urge to criticize, keep your mouth shut. Feel what drives the urge. So instead of speaking, like, you just don't speak and you look. So it's that exact thing that we do as Buddhists, as nangpas, as people who look inside. We feel the urge to criticize somebody else, turn that right around and look at our own motivation. Feel what drives that urge. He says, you are comparing yourself with others because that part of you feels less than. Know that deficiency and know that it is a feeling and not a fact. Again, we're trying to dissolve the filters and the projections. Know that it's just a feeling. It's just an opinion. It's not the way things truly are. He says, rest in that knowing and then move into taking and sending. So first we shut up. Then we look inside. We recognize our motivation. We recognize how we feel. And we rest in that feeling. And we do taking and sending for ourselves. Take in the feeling of being deficient. Take in the feeling of being deficient. Oh, take it in from others and give them joy and freedom in return. So this is that thing that's the post-meditation for taking and sending, where if we feel deficient, then we take in everybody's feelings of deficiency and we send happiness and whatever non-deficiency is to everyone. He says, the more you feel joy in others and in your life, the more you undermine the critical mechanism in yourself. And I had... we're just on 32, right? Something very short from Dingo Chensei Rinpoche. Let me see what I have. He just, I hope everybody read his commentary and we'll read it again because it's very, very pithy. He says, here's another reminder, as the Buddha said, an ordinary person cannot assess another ordinary person, only a Buddha can. And that goes back to what Lama Jinzang was saying, it can never know where the other person is coming from. We cannot know the reality of their situation. And he also says, he ends with some advice, treat one another with great kindness and openness. And above all, do not look for one another's mistakes. Once you start finding defects somewhere, you will see them everywhere and in everyone. So just don't do it. That Ken said it the clearest, just don't do it. Anybody have anything they want to say? We have about 20 minutes left and 2 verses to cover, but we'll just cover what we cover. And if anybody has anything to contribute, I'm happy to turn the floor over. Then we're on to verse 33. So those two are very intertwined. Look at our own faults, leave others alone. Unless it's a situation where we know it's going to have a positive effect. And that is a very difficult thing to know, but it could happen. So verse 33, to give up attachment to worldly domains. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this one. This is sort of geared towards people who teach. I guess it's also geared towards any practitioners. When I am swayed by honor and reward, I may fall prey to quarrels and discord, and motivation may disintegrate to study, contemplate, and meditate. Abandoning attachment to domains, the literal word in the Tibetan is the homes or the households. Of benefactors, relatives, and friends. this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So for those of us in particular who share the Dharma, whether it's as like a lama, like an official teacher, or somebody who runs a center, or just somebody who others know to be a Buddhist practitioner, we need to pay attention to what reward we may get from that, whether it's feeling respected or whether they make donations to us. We have to be very, very careful not to fall prey to that as our motivation for sharing the Dharma or practicing the Dharma. So what I have here, first I wanted to read a very short commentary from Kenpo Sutren Jamsa Rinpoche. So he has a very short commentary on this one. He says, under the influence of desire for gain and recognition, even a bodhisattva may end up arguing over possessions and demanding special considerations. Preoccupied with such desire, the ordinary bodhisattva's activities of listening, analyzing, and meditating will decrease. These are good reasons for giving up attachment to the households of relatives, friends, and sponsors, to the worlds, to the circles, to just being involved with them. It doesn't mean we separate ourselves out, although that is a good thing to do sometimes, to do retreat if we can, to go be in a cave, to just be secluded and do our practice. Doesn't mean we have to cut all ties, but we just don't get involved with their stuff, and especially with the back and forth of wanting to be in their favor and so forth. So let me see what else I have here. So I have something from Ken McLeod on this one, and I'm going to ask Lama Jinzong to share briefly you said it was brief. So here's what Ken says. He says, imagine that you are going to die in 1 minute. Let's take a second to imagine that, like, the truck is coming towards us and we can't get out of the way. Like, we have, like, 1 moment to live. He says, wherever you are when you read this or hear this, stop. In 1 minute, you are going to die. 1 minute. So how did you spend the last minute of your life? Were you concerned about status at work, in your family, or with your friends? What about recognition, rewards, or accomplishments? What you owned, how wealthy or poor you are, what people would think of you when you're gone. He says, in all likelihood, you grew quiet inside, very quiet. You looked around, taking in everything you could see. You felt a bit in awe at the prospect, wondering perhaps what the end of life is like. But it's, you know, suddenly everything else falls away when you know that you're going to die. He says, in the light of death, you see clearly what is important and what is not. You are amazed at how much time and life energy you dissipate in matters that in the end do not mean much to you or do not make much difference in your life. In the long run, wealth, status, and influence are much less important than the moment-to-moment experience of life itself. So I'm going to let that go because I want to bring in this really lovely little thing from Pema Chodron. It was a throwaway comment based on something that her co-teacher Tim Olmsted had said about rainbows. She said, listening to Tim talk about rainbows, and this is about verse 30. Well, it was the introduction to verse 31. Listening to Tim talk about rainbows, I had what I thought was a great analogy. So she was referring back to verse 9, which is like the second motivation for traveling the path. She says, and she quotes, that the happiness of the three worlds disappears like a dewdrop on a blade of, I have a typo here that's very funny, sorry, on a blade of grain. It's actually a blade of grass. But anyway, two dewdrops on a blade of grass. That's how quickly our happiness, our worldly happiness evaporates, right? We all got that one. She says, how about if there were two dewdrops on a blade of grass fighting with each other? And the sun is out and they're evaporating, but they spend their whole existence in this quarreling. Poignant. So next time you're quarreling, think of yourselves as two dewdrops on a blade of grass wasting your time. So I thought that was exactly what Ken McLeod is saying here. Like all of this stuff that we get involved in with our friends, relatives, benefactors, coworkers, et cetera, if we knew we were going to die in 1 minute, we wouldn't waste our time. So let's know that we could die in 1 minute and not waste our time. Lama Chinsong, do you want to bring in what His Holiness?
Yeah, it's very brief, and it actually speaks to, it was referred to in Dingo Kensi Rinpoche's, he mentions the same quote. Dingo Kensi gives the actual author, and here he just says Kadampa Masters. So all he has to say is, the principal message of this stanza is that we need to abandon attachment to acquisition and respect, and beyond the idea that you would compete with other practitioners about getting the same pool of sponsorship, etc. But what he says in the greater, you know, beyond that is, about this, the great early Kadampa master said, the possession of contentment is the greatest wealth, and the absence of craving is the greatest happiness. So without contentment, even, do you hear like a sweeping sound? Is that coming from, oh, sorry.
Probably coming from you, actually, or it might, I don't know. I'll mute myself just.
Okay. The principal message of this, So without contentment, even if someone came to own the entire world, the whole planet, they would not be satisfied, and they would therefore not be happy. On the other hand, if you have contentment, then even if your clothing and food are meager or shoddy, you'll still be happy. Likewise, if you have no craving, if you don't want things particularly, you'll be perfectly happy, because not wanting things, you won't be worried about getting them. Therefore, you won't be stressed out, and you'll be perfectly happy. And if I can just add, so that's what he said, but this is what Lama Norla Rinpoche said many years ago, and it always stuck with me. Like in Nindro, for the Guru Yoga, the term, there are several terms for contentment, but one of them is jhurme, which means literally having no needs. So that he was talking about, like in when he first came to India, to him, you know, those he saw with incredible wealth in his mind were the most impoverished of all. Because he talked about this as like a sense of impoverishment. And so this idea is that if you're happy, if you're content with whatever you have, if you have this idea that I don't need anything else, then if something comes to you, fine, or if something doesn't come to you, fine. But its contentment was like literally not having any needs. Like whatever you have now, it's enough. That's it.
That reminds me that of that verse that you used to always quote in the old days, that he said practitioners, that was like their motto, Tibetan practitioners, was whatever happens, happens, whatever comes, comes, I don't need anything at all. He said we should just always think like that. So I wanted to end like this one. I was going to bring in Dingo Chensi Rinpoche, and I think you covered that. Is the Karmapa in his book, Traveling the Path of Compassion, actually comes at this from a whole different point of view, which is that this is a way that you can also evaluate a prospective teacher. Like, what extent are they involved with worldly things? Like, are they doing it for money? Are they teaching Dharma so that they can become rich and famous and have a really fabulous reputation and so forth and advance amongst the ranks of teachers? He says, all we really need to do for practice is to study, reflect, and meditate. However, these days it is common in the East and the West that desire for honor and gain creates problems. Imitation monks, phony lamas, fake tulkus, and false gods turn up, and because of this, it is difficult to find the right kind of study, reflection, and meditation. So what that means is that if you have a teacher, if you're relying on a teacher who's clearly preoccupied with sort of worldly ambition, they can't teach the path of liberation because they're not liberated themselves. I mean, that throws us back to verse 7, like in themselves in prison in samsari's jail. Like, how can they protect us? So he says, it is very important for everyone to be careful about this and try to see clearly what is genuine and what is false. If someone says, I am a lama, or I am a tulku, or I am a god, we do not have to immediately follow them. First, investigate to see whether they are genuine or not and whether we should make a connection with them. It is important to use our critical faculties along with giving up attachment. So you want to be careful not to follow a teacher who's very involved. This was actually in one of the other, I think it was in, I don't remember which commentary, and it may be in Gampopa, when he gives the criteria for, you know, for an authentic teacher, is I think actually Ringu Tulku said it. If they're in, if you see that they're involved with the eight worldly concerns, then don't go there. You know, if they're still stuck in the eight worldly concerns, profit, gain, happiness, unhappiness, or, you know, or discomfort, comfort, praise and blame, good reputation versus bad reputation. If they care about those things, then they cannot teach you the path to freedom because they are still stuck too. So I just thought that was an interesting take on that verse. All right, does anybody have anything they'd like to say before we zip through verse 34, which is like a, it's like a no-brainer verse, verse 34, although we do need to practice it. All right, Fanny, yes.
Hi. So again, the discernment of a authentic teacher, and you know, when does one say, "Oh, I've learned so much from them. They really taught me this," and then they also have navigated a human condition. You know, maybe they. So even at this juncture, there's. You know, I grapple with that, like mm-hmm. having the space for all of it. So, you know, it seems a little bit almost dualistic in some ways, and maybe I'm using the wrong conceptual term, that, you know, not to get specific here, but, you know, here's somebody that has shown you the path, has opened it up. There's a dedication and a devotion, and they're also learning about their own human frailties and flaws and going down that. So that still coexists, I think. You know, can't you learn something from everyone? You know, and then internalize it yourself and see what resonates for yourself. That's what that you know, or is that still the filter that we're looking through?
Yeah, they have to like stop you there, Fanny.
Yeah.
My best with that very briefly that yeah, we don't expect anybody to be perfect. And the Karmapa actually addressed this in his teachings that, you know, and it doesn't contradict what he said in the book. Like, we not expect them to be perfect, but we do look at the balance, I think. But he said the real criterion for determining whether a teacher is authentic for you is whether they change you, whether you change for the better. So they don't have to be perfect. You can learn from anybody. I probably won't get to some of the things. I think Dingo Chensei Rinpoche in one of the verses points out that we can't know somebody's level of realization. We can't evaluate that. And that as, what was her name? Karma Wangmo, the woman who did 12 years of retreat at KTD back in the old days, one of the things she said that I really liked was, anybody on the street could be more enlightened than you. You can't know. So, yeah, so we just do our best. It's like, do their flaws affect us, like what we're getting from them? Lama Jinzang, I saw your hand. Did you have something to say?
No. I mean, I had looked back to what he said about the spiritual friend, but we already went over that in another class. So,
okay, yeah, I think we'll leave that one there, and I hope that was helpful, and thanks for bringing that up, Fanny. I just wanted to touch on, and we won't be doing this again, four verses in one class, but we needed to do it today. So verse 34, to refrain from harsh speech. Like this is one of the 10 on virtuous actions. This is like a no-brainer, but we do it all the time anyway. So the verse is, harsh words, besides upsetting other people, impair my bodhisattva practice too. To give up speech that's harsh, rude, or abusive, unpleasant for recipients to hear, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Just don't do it. It's another one. It's like Ken saying, just don't criticize other people. Well, just don't speak harshly to other people either. But we do because we get carried away by our own emotional reactivity. So we're going to do it. But we learn to recognize, we look at our own faults, right? This goes back to verse 31. We know that we do that. We catch ourselves doing that. And we go through the four-step process. Recognize, resolve never to do it again. Rely on the refuges, remediate. We do those things. So we will do it, but we aspire not to ever do it. And so first I'm going to read Kenpo Sultan Jamso Rinpoche. We have 5 minutes left. He says, we are advised for two reasons to give up harsh words that displease others. First, our conduct disturbs the minds of others. It upsets them. You may recall situations when someone spoke to you sharply or unkindly or unfairly laid blame on you. You became disturbed, frustrated, depressed. Imagine somebody that like made some mistake and everybody's tweeting about it now. You know, I mean, they have to go into hiding. He says, perhaps the harshness even made you cry. This is why it is wise to remember that harsh or unpleasant speech causes others pain the same way it does you. The second reason to give up harsh speech is because it compromises a bodhisattva's right conduct, which is to benefit others. Disturbing someone's mind accomplishes just the opposite. It causes harm. Therefore, harsh and unpleasant speech violates the bodhisattva vow. It's an impairment of our bodhisattva vow. So I have something from Karmapa's book. We'll just read what we have time for. About 35. Okay, he says, he says the same thing. Putting ourselves in someone else's place, we ask, if someone said these words to me in that way, how would I feel? When we truly think of others, which is our job as bodhisattvas, right, others first, we will find some part of them that resembles us because every one of us experiences pleasure and pain. Before we act or speak, thinking of others as similar to us is quite useful. So put our first rule, put ourselves in their place. How would I feel if somebody said to me what I'm about to say to this person? So that could stop you. I have something from Pema Chidren. She says, perhaps our speech is very harsh and other people are wounded by it continually, but we ourselves don't recognize it. Maybe people tell us we speak harshly and we don't think we do. With self-reflection, you begin to pick up the cues. And she brings in an interesting point about humor. You think you're being witty, like New York City witty. So you see it as quite clever and smart. You have these retorts, but you don't realize it's often at other people's expense or hurts their feelings. So that takes us back to verse 31, to always be mindful of our own behavior, our own conduct, and its effect on others, and always be vigilant. You know, we know that we're not supposed to be hurting other people. So then you also have to be vigilant, as Lama Jinzong, you know, told us from the Karmapa, to know whether we're doing it or not. You have to have that radar, like, am I about to really upset somebody with my sense of humor or my anger or my constructive criticism that's really just, you know, out of jealousy or bad mood or whatever. She also brings in, somebody asked her a question about speaking abusively to herself. So sometimes we're harsh to ourselves, and Ken, we won't get to it, but Ken also talks about that. And so what do you do if you find yourself always speaking harshly to yourself? Pema Chidren says, if there's a key thing, it's developing loving kindness toward yourself. Being so clear about what you do to yourself, that's already standing apart a little bit because you know what's happening. So first is just to recognize that you're doing it, and that takes you out of it. And then you can even do things like, let's rerun what I just said to myself and say it with a kind voice instead of a harsh voice. The honesty is there because we do want to be looking at our faults. So it's about bringing the kindness in. And that's back to what the Karmapa said, is we don't have to get down on ourselves just because we have a fault. Don't listen to the harsh voice. And I liked the idea of rerunning it. Let's try that again. So I think we're pretty much out of time. Lama Jinzong, do you have some quick thing from Karmapa?
No, just he said everything. It's just recognizing that when we speak harshly, why are we speaking harshly? If we're motivated by the three poisons, aversion, you know, whatever, that again, tone of voice is emotionally based. So, you know, recognizing that, you know, again, looking back at yourself, like you're saying, and yeah. You know, why do we need to speak harshly? You know, why can't we just keep it business? You know, it's got to do with our being, it's our emotionality, acting out on our own. At, you know, emotionality.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to share from Ken, and I know this is a lot of stuff. I hope that it's helpful to bring in all this stuff rather than go more slowly and not bring in as many things. I tend to be on the side of throwing a lot of stuff at you. But so Ken says, he gives us a hint for how we could become aware of the quality of our speech. He says, when you speak, listen to the sound of your own voice. as if you were listening to another person. You may not like what you hear, but listen anyway. And then he talks later about then he talks about speaking harshly to another person. He says, we should look at it, just hear it, and then look at the other person and take in the situation, open to everything that is going on inside you and outside you, and then start again. So that's, I think he's saying the same thing that Pema Chidren said. It's like, even with another person, you could go back and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean for it to come out like that. This is what I meant, and say it in a kind way, or say, let's just forget the whole thing. I don't think there's anything else. I have like one thing marked from Dingo Chense, and he's always a good place to end. But I don't think that anything is really added that we need to take extra time for. So reread Dingo Chense. Remember the point of all these verses, the four instructions from the sutra, which is to rein in our own behavior. As bodhisattvas, we have to be very careful about our conduct towards others, and as several commentaries brought in, about ourselves, like how we treat ourselves. So we look at our own faults, don't look at other people's faults, don't speak harshly, and really focus on our own practice, our own study, contemplation, and meditation, and don't get involved in a lot of worldly considerations that will corrupt our practice. So does anybody have anything to say before we do our prayers? Okay, I'm looking to see if I had anything else we had to cover. No, we were going to chant it again. You can chant the verses on your own. Everybody should have them. So I'm going to pull out my prayers. And we'll do our dedication. We'll dedicate the merit of this intense study today, these four verses. Our resolution not to speak harshly and not to find fault with other people. We'll dedicate that to the benefit and enlightenment of all sentient beings. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence. Kuntu Zangpo and Manjushri, to train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication, please fulfill, and we'll just let our minds come to rest for just a moment. In open awareness, but with a warm heart. And hopefully we'll take that with us out into the rest of our day. So any comments on how that went? Like, was it too much to try to cover four verses, or was it all right? Yeah, so Marilyn's going. Yeah, well, you know, we do our best. But anyway, I just didn't want to run through the summer, so that's the sacrifice we make. And please reread your Dingo Chense, because it's all in there. All right, so I'm going to unmute everybody to say goodbye, and next week we will... All right. Thank you, Lama Jinzang.
Thank you, Lama Jinzang. Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Lama.